This week's episode of Offworld is made possible by Emerald Code on Sorta TV. Emerald Code is a series about teenage friends as they solve problems using STEM concepts. In the latest season, the gang heads off to space camp and conduct some pretty funky experiments. If you're a teacher or a parent, this is an amazing way to get preteens and young women in your life into the fields of science, technology, engineering, and math. Emerald Code. Get with the programming.
Welcome back to Offworld, the show where we talk about all things space exploration and pop culture. I am Ariel Waldman.
And I'm Norm Chan. And I think we have a really fun episode for y'all this week. It is a movie that came out over 20 years ago now.
Yeah, Starship Troopers. And we have a couple of really, really awesome scientists from the California Academy of Sciences who are here to talk about bugs and kind of be in the bugs' defense.
I can't wait. Let's take a listen.
So today I'm with Dr. Lauren Esposito and Dr. Brian Fisher, but thank you both so much for coming on the show today.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, so if you could both actually introduce yourselves and say a little bit about what you do, Lauren.
I am the curator of arachnology at the California Academy of Sciences, and I study the evolution of scorpions, spiders, and their venoms.
Awesome. Brian?
I do not study scorpions, but I study ants, and I've been studying ants for, well, most like 25 years. I love ants.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're pretty creepy and awesome, in my opinion. So we're speaking of creepy and awesome, we're talking about Starship Troopers today, 1997 film, definitely very campy, also a lot of fun, most of all for the fact that they depict what they call bugs in the film. Lauren, what did you think of the depiction of bugs and insects in the film generally? What was your feeling as being a sort of a bug expert watching bugs, well, I guess, get murdered a lot on film?
Well, you know, I guess I would say that bugs is a really general word. And when I think of the word bugs as a professional entomologist, like, the first thing that comes to mind is actually not insects at all, or arachnids, but rather like things that make you sick. So initially, before I really like got into the film and knew what was going on and knew what they were describing, like, I didn't really know what kind of bugs it was. But I will say that I was particularly disturbed by the fact that they really villainize these bugs when really bugs are our friends. And the worst part of all was that scene where they're all stomping on the cockroaches and they're like so excited about it.
Oh,
I just felt so sad. Felt so
Those
sad
are
in that
Malagasy
scene.
Malagasy hissing cockroaches.
I know.
And I work
know.
In Madagascar and I was actually saddened.
And they take so long to grow up too, and they're like these big adult Malagasy hissing cockroaches, and it was like a tragedy for them to be stung. But they were really excited about it in the movie.
And insects are often depicted like that, though.
I mean, they're maligned.
Either insects are invisible to everybody, or all of a sudden they're the most awful thing.
It's true.
Yeah. So when I explain bugs as being creepy awesome, what would you say instead?
Infinite beauty. If you actually take the time to look at one under the microscope, you'll be fascinated. It's like the most beautiful art you could ever imagine.
So speaking of art, what did you think of the depiction in terms of visuals of how these insects were actually shown on the film and sort of, I guess, their size and their colors and structure?
Well, I can imagine those who designed it wanted more, but they were a bit limited maybe by their robotic abilities. But they look more like robots than insects. But they had some interesting detail, which I appreciated, one who studies ants. They were often in groups, working together maybe. That wasn't really shown across very well in the film, but one could imagine if they did have a brain and lots of other CAS, worker ants, maybe, that it was a social society.
Yeah. What did
I
you
guess
think?
Ants are kind of a warring society, for that matter.
Warring, no, it's just a depiction of from whose side you're on. So an ant is basically going to defend where they live. You know, they don't have to build a wall. They just actually go out and mark their territories.
A chemical wall.
A chemical wall, that's true. A smart wall. And also, when you look at an individual ant, that's not the ant. It's like a leaf on a tree. The ant is actually the collective whole. The organism is called a superorganism. And that was very similar to the film, right? You could kill one of those workers and they still kept coming. You know, people always say, get the ants out of my house. And they're going to like, we got to kill them. I'm like, wake up. There's a billion outside. They're just going to come in and keep coming in when it gets rainy outside. So killing them is not the right approach.
Individually.
Individually.
So, I mean, we certainly see, you know, all these hordes of different arachnid-like creatures come in. What did you think of the depiction of arachnids? You know, certainly we're all sort of familiar with ants sort of having colonies, but what about arachnids in general?
Well, what I would say is that what I really liked about the film is that there's all these different kinds of bugs. In the beginning, they like in one of the first earlier scenes, they're like in a lab dissecting one like you would do in high school biology or something. And it's vastly different from the ones that are that they're combating against initially. And so there was definitely like multiple different kinds of bugs that were depicted, which was I thought was interesting. And each of them, you could see where they drew their inspiration from in nature. Like some of them had kind of beetle heads and others had sort of like an isopteran or a crustacean kind of body. And some of them looked like weevils. But the arachnids, I really have to take issue with, because while they were called arachnids, there was nothing arachnid about them.
Yeah, so break that down. What was not arachnid about the arachnids?
Well, arachnids have a few really like hallmark features that make them an arachnid. The first is that they have 8 legs. These guys only had 4, so forget it. Already they're not an arachnid, right? Secondly, arachnids have really 2 major body parts. They have the prosoma, which is like the head, and the opisthosoma, which is like the rest of the body. And these guys, they really just kind of had 1 body part with like a mouth attached at the front. The other thing that arachnids have that's super important is mouth parts called chelicerae. They're chewing mouth parts. These guys did not have chelicerae. They had just like this giant, like, it almost looked kind of like a rhinoceros beetle head, but it was like the mouth part, you know, it's just for like grabbing and impaling things. And I guess that's the other thing is that arachnids never really impale. They sting or they bite, but they don't impale things and then like absorb them instantaneously into their mouth. So arachnids, I'm not really convinced, but bugs, okay. You can take them.
Well, so an interesting thing about that. So this film, I think, was made like a few years after Jurassic Park, and the animation studio who worked on it was the same that worked on Jurassic Park. And I think I had read that they made the arachnids have 4 legs because the computing power to make 8 legs was too much in 1997.
Yeah, so, I can imagine that.
So they're half arachnids, you know.
They're half arachnids. But kind of like Brian said, like they look sort of robotic. It almost looked like they had these 4 legs. And then on top of it, almost like a tank was this like pivoting body that like pivoted on top of all 4 legs. Arachnids, really, their legs come into their prosoma, into their head, and all those muscles like come around inside of their head, and so it's really all integrated into one seamless feature.
Well, so let's talk about the size of the bugs also. Well,
like, we've ignored them.
Yeah, I mean, that's like the pretty huge thing of, you know, what if these killer bugs in outer space were really, really big, which made me want to ask you all about, you know, how large have bugs, insects, arachnids gotten in the history of Earth? You know, we usually associate them with being fairly small, although recently in the news there's been the super bee or huge bee that was rediscovered. Mm-hmm. You know, how large have insects gotten in the history of Earth? Have they gotten that large? Have they gotten close to that large?
Well, I'll let Brian talk about the insects, but I can tell you arachnids, at least the ancestors of modern-day arachnids, were huge. There was this thing called a Eurypterid, which is informally called a sea spider or a sea scorpion. And these things were massive. They were like 2 meters long. They were really like the grizzlies of the ocean. They were predators. And it was these Eurypterids that first started coming onto land and became amphibious. And it's been hypothesized that they were actually going up into rivers and eating salmon out of rivers, just like grizzlies do today. So they were really huge. I would say not quite as big as the arachnids in the film, but they were certainly 1 meter or 2 in length.
But those were in the ocean. And so that explains.
Indeed.
One limitation of an exoskeleton is that it's heavy, but if you're in the ocean, you got some buoyancy. And maybe on these planets, the gravitational pull is less, so they could support a larger exoskeleton.
Plus the oxygen levels.
And that's the other point. Why and when in our history on Earth we've had large insects. And it really determines their ability to absorb enough, you know, oxygen to actually keep everything working with muscles.
Because do all insects passively respire, like arachnids?
Passively. Yeah, so they're passive. They don't have a lung, so they have to be able to. So if you increase the percentage of oxygen in the air, you can actually absorb it quicker, and then you can be a bigger insect. So in the past, you've had much larger insects. You've had even ants that were like this big.
Whoa.
Yeah, even you can. We have great fossil deposits in Colorado and Wyoming and see them. But I think like the largest fossil insect is like
it's a dragonfly, right?
Yeah,
it's like, yeah. And it was like, I think like a meter wingspan, something like that.
Maybe not that big, but almost that big.
It's like, well, the wings. Yeah, the wings don't need any oxygen.
And in the movie, we see these wasp-like, dragonfly-like sort of creatures come in as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
that's like the evolution, right?
Right. So let's look at it from an evolutionary point of view, which is like, to me, the most interesting part. So convergence is a common scenario in our world.
Which is what?
Earth. Convergence would be, for example, you drop some living thing into an isolated island like Madagascar, and then it just evolves into be something very different and fill the niches that maybe other insects or animals fill in Africa. And that's an example where you have this kind of radiation and it takes on different roles. So if you have this great kind of like strategy of filling niches called the arachnid morphotype, but this time it has four legs because of some historical scenario.
The arachnid morphotype being a predator.
A predator, right?
All right.
And
I'll take that.
And then it just actually then sets off and evolves. Now obviously, niches have to be filled. Now, the question is, on the planet, what niche are these filling, right? Because they don't seem to have anything to eat unless humans are there.
It's pretty desert-y. But there are those other bugs. Those other bugs are there.
But they seem to be all working together.
Yeah, it's because true. They ate all those other bugs up.
But then what are the other bugs eating?
You know what? It might have been a thriving planet before these things evolved and got out of control. You know what? Maybe it's really like a metaphor for humanity.
There are a lot of metaphors in this movie, some of which we're not going into today. But I certainly appreciate like all the propaganda visuals and just overtones of this movie, which is a bit nuts. Although they don't really, you know, to both of your points, they don't really paint these insects in a very sort of sympathetic light. You know,
I would say it's damaging for insect reputations.
Yeah.
But it's not just them. It's constant. Even the BBC does that when they do like Planet Earth. They'll show you beautiful scenarios of penguins. In the next scene, they'll show you locusts in Madagascar and say, oh, evil, we're going to help kill them. Here we've teamed up with the pesticide company to go out and kill them. I'm like, excuse me, the locals eat edible insects, and locusts are one of the most nutritious foods in Madagascar.
And abundant. Yeah.
And abundant.
Well, so getting back to the whole thing about, you know, other planets. So you could imagine, based on the history of Earth and life as we know it, that there may be other planets in our galaxy, imagining that if they have a lot more oxygen than we do in their atmosphere, that there are potentially planets that could have bugs and insects that get as large or close to as large as we see in the movie. So it's not entirely made up that insects could actually get this large.
No, I mean, I think that it's conceivable that somewhere in the universes there's another planet that is similar enough to Earth in that it contains oxygen and has the similar kinds of habitats like oceans and land and things that are primary producers like our equivalent of plants, and then something eating those like our equivalent of ants, and then something that comes along that evolves convergently, so it's evolving to occupy a similar space as our arachnids, that's just really giant because its prey is giant, and what the prey is eating is also giant because of increased levels of oxygen or some other kind of chemical.
Because the body plan of insects solves a problem very efficiently. One, it takes low input, so it doesn't waste energy on heat and requires less water, but also because the skeleton's on the outside and the muscles are on the inside. And that provides a lot of like Newtonian advantage. You get great leverage. You can lift more for your size, and it just works so much better. In fact, it's in many ways a superior body plan than putting your muscles on the outside and your bones on the inside.
And then something on top of all of that, like your skin, to hold it all in. Like this is just like killing two birds with one stone.
So on that, so do you think insects and bugs are really amenable to living in extreme conditions that we might see on other planets or moons? And, you know, in the news a lot is tardigrades for their ability to, you know, be all over the Earth like many insects are, but also for their ability to survive the vacuum of space for at least a few days and then come back and be unfazed. Yeah. Do some insects have that ability as well?
I mean, let's just talk about arachnids, because they are arachnids after all. So just taking scorpions, which is a kind of arachnid, there's scorpions in caves 100 meters below sea level, and there's scorpions in the Alps. There's scorpions in every ecosystem on Earth with the exception of the Arctic and Antarctica. So I think that that just goes to show that in just this one organism, it's persisted for 450 million years on this planet. It is really, really good at adapting to incredibly harsh environments, from the driest desert to the most humid tropical forest, all the way up to like cold freezing temperatures that where there's almost permafrost year round. So just in this one example of arachnids, and there's lots of different kinds of arachnids. There's spiders, there's mites, there's daddy long legs or harvest men, we call them. So that's just talking about arachnids, never mind all the insects, which outnumber the arachnids by far in terms of both the diversity, the different kinds that are out there, but also like sheer number.
Yeah. So it's their ability to manage those extreme points. Because even in the Alps, there's days where it's like, you know, the tropics, it's really hot outside. And that's they can just take advantage of that by shutting down, in a sense, during the coldest periods. And that ability to shut down is thanks in part to having their skeleton on the outside and being able to close off all their places they breathe and just kind of almost hibernate for a few hours even. But others can actually throw antifreeze through their whole body and survive.
They like produce it, essentially.
They produce their own antifreeze and they can survive.
So there's all these like really ingenious, for lack of a better word, adaptations that we see in insects and arachnids just here on this planet that I would say would allow them to withstand some incredibly harsh conditions like I would imagine on other planets. But then again, maybe other planets are like quite nice and luxurious, and we really don't know, I guess, is the end of the...
Maybe it's best that we don't know. We don't learn that we're like, oh man, we could have been on that other planet. It's really...
It's like mosquito-free.
Yeah.
Well, I think planet Earth is beautiful.
It is. I agree.
And it's fully losing its charm in some places, thanks to us, but... It is our beautiful blue planet.
Well, so part of the beauty to me in animals and insects are, you know, their intelligence. And I think we oftentimes underestimate their intelligence or don't really recognize intelligence in other creatures, or sometimes like othering of intelligence. So the intelligence that we see in the film, you know, we see the a lot of different species working together. We see this huge brain bug that they're trying to service. That's sort of like a queen bee analog. Yeah. You know, what sorts of intelligence did you see in the film, and how does that like hold up to intelligence as you see in your studies?
That's an interesting question, because ants and others make a great example of comparing the two. So in ants, you have high intelligence, you could say, which means they can communicate. And I didn't really see much communication going on in the film with the brain and the other species. And it could be that they're just different castes. It could just be the same species we saw. And just like ants, they've evolved to have some that are the soldiers and some that are the little workers and stuff. And that's the brilliance of ants. People say ants are so great because they work together like a family, they're social, but it's actually more than that. It's incredible because they have different sizes. You can have a large ant and a small ant, and it could be almost 100 times in size difference. And that difference allows them to actually take on different jobs, just like we saw in the film.
It's like cooperative intelligence.
It's cooperative intelligence and division of labor intelligence. And you know that if you took an ant colony and counted all the neurons in it, it'd be about as many neurons as a human. So
that's
in terms of neural capacity, an ant colony is about as much as a human. But that brain had a big brain in the movie, and that's a lot of neurons in there.
Before we continue on with this week's episode, I want to let you know that Offworld is made possible with support from Emerald Code on Sorta TV, an amazing show for teachers and parents. We know how hard it can be to get the younger people in your life to embrace STEM fields, especially young women. Emerald Code is a series that really focuses on helping younger people grow their interest in STEM by showing how they can use these concepts to solve problems in real life. The series provides great role models for young people who might be a bit shy about stepping into scientific communities they're interested in. Check out Sorta TV for lots more STEM content, like their DIY experiment show, STEMily, and Decoded, which focuses on real girls making a difference in STEM fields. Subscribe to the Sorta TV channel at youtube.com/SortaTV, or if you're watching the video, by clicking the links in the description below. Once again, that's youtube.com/SORTATV. Now back to the conversation.
Yeah, well, what about with arachnids? Do you see as many like community sort of based intelligence or not so much?
Generally speaking, arachnids are not cooperative. They live individually and maybe come together for the purposes of reproduction. So in some cases, males and females will raise eggs semi-cooperatively. Often we see things like maternal care where the mom's taking care of either the eggs or the eggs and the babies once they hatch, or the eggs and the babies once they hatch and after they grow up for a while. So we see that kind of cooperation. We don't ever see the level of cooperation or collective intelligence like we do in ants and other social insects. But I mean, I think that there's certainly some clear indication that there's an intelligence present in the tiny little cluster of neurons that we call a brain in arachnids. For example, there's a jumping spider that lives in Australia, and it feeds on mosquitoes only. It's just a mosquito eater. But this little arachnid actually prefers to eat mosquitoes that have been blood-fed. So it's able to detect blood-fed mosquitoes and then preferentially eat them. And it doesn't do this from birth. It actually learns that it prefers to feed on these blood-fed mosquitoes.
Does it learn through itself or through watching others? Or?
It's unclear whether it learns on its own just from eating or whether it learns from watching others. But we know that it prefers to eat blood-fed mosquitoes if it's experienced blood-fed mosquitoes. And we see this all the time, this kind of like learning where arachnids learn to modify their behavior based on past experiences. So I was just listening to a presentation last week at an arachnology conference, and this one was about whether certain spiders prefer to mate with male spiders that look like their father, or to mate with male spiders that look like a different kind of variation on the morphology. Okay. And it turns out that they prefer to mate with the ones that they see another female mating with.
Right.
So if they first see a female mating with, like, they're contained, right? So they can just see, like, through glass.
Yeah.
They can see a female mating with one kind of male, like, color or size or whatever. Then they'll, once they reach sexual maturity, they'll prefer to mate with that male. So it's actually, like, a clear demonstration of learning behavior in arachnids.
Oh.
Just like the ones in the movie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, also, so there was a lot of depiction in the movie of different weaponry that sort of these creatures have. And we see things like almost a fire-breathing beetle.
Oh, no, no. Something like that. That was clearly a bombardier beetle, right?
Right? That's exactly what I was
no
thinking.
Fire. It's clearly...
It's chemicals.
Two chemicals sprayed together and they just blow up. That's real.
Okay. That's a real. It doesn't come out of their mouth.
You have to explain that then. What happens in real life with these beetles?
Well, it's not like, just the bombardiers. There's the postlions who do the same thing. But the bombardiers are the classic famous ones where, as a defense, they throw two chemicals together and those explode.
And they basically like push them out of the air holes in the side of their body. So they have like little glands and right next to where their air holes are. And they just kind of like push them out, and it sprays this chemical out into the air when they're like getting attacked. And it's like chemical
explodes?
It's chemical burn. It's acid.
Oh,
it's
wow. Acid.
Ants do it too. There's a kamikaze ant that blows itself up when it's being attacked to take down its predators with it. It's pretty amazing.
Well, that's kind of cool. So, you know, we talked about how the impaling and everything wasn't very realistic.
Well, the impaling is realistic for some things.
Yeah, piercing sucking mouth parts are the usual tool for piercing. And when they went into the brain, that was classic. Reduviidae. It's a bug that has a piercing, sucking mouth part that goes into its prey.
It's called the kissing bug.
Lovely.
Or the assassin bugs.
Yeah. Okay, so they definitely chose their...
And I've actually seen one sitting on a leaf with another kind of bug, a little plant bug, impaled through its rostrum, through its beak.
Oh, my God.
It's terrifying.
That does sound terrifying. So what other weapons did we see sort of in the movie? We saw...
Well, they have kind of like crazy beak mandible thing. And for me, when I saw those, I just thought Hercules beetles.
Oh, yeah.
Because they have these horns that they use for male-male combat, actually. So they use them in sparring. And it's for... They spar over access to females, which don't have horns. And that's the first thing I thought when I saw those like big horn kind of mouth parts.
You see, because as we're explaining, in morphology, function is often depicted in the morphology, right? So the muscle attachments and its function you can get from looking at it. But there's one thing I couldn't figure out looking at the brain. Mm-hmm. How does it reproduce? Like,
maybe it wasn't all brain and it was just all reproductive. Like,
it could have been
organs.
Ovaries.
Yeah, it could have been just a
thing. It could be like a giant termite or a queen ant.
It kind of looks like a giant termite. Yeah, and we also saw, again, beetle-like ones that had like firefly sort of back ends that like sort of lit up and then lit up the sky with firework-like weapons or something.
I think that was this bombardier beetle. But there was another example right in the beginning that was actually throwing spores.
Colonize other planets or something. Yeah, which is a big part of the whole plot of the movie is, you know, this whole, like, are they attacking us? You know, I guess we have to go attack them and all the propaganda associated with that.
And I don't know, like, to my knowledge, I don't know of any insects that reproduce kind of like spawnily like that. But because insects are really just crustaceans, they did at some point reproduce spawnily.
Yeah, so it's
not too far off base. Okay, so my final question for both of you is, what sort of bugs in space movie would you like to see? We talked a lot about how this sort of demonizes bugs a lot and insects. And what sort of bugs in space movie would you like to see? Or what sort of aspects would you like to be illuminated about the reality of many insects and arachnids?
I mean, I personally like this movie. Like, I think it's great. It's hilarious. It's like, there's a lot going on. There's lots of things to laugh about. And certainly there's a lot of depiction of these animals that draws from nature, even if it's not entirely accurate. But that's like what imagination is, right? It's the best, I think many of the best aspects of our imagination are drawing from real life. Like the scariest movies, like Alien, Predator, anything like that. It draws from nature. Like, I see that, and as an entomologist, as an arachnologist, I know exactly what they were looking at when they first designed this. But you know, I guess I would be hard-pressed to say what I would like to see in a movie. What do you think?
I don't know if you took it as if you took bugs from Earth, and then they went to space. What would they evolve into? What kind of societies and
like niches? An experiment gone wrong.
Yeah, so we took insects from, but I have this idea that, you know, life is just like almost DNA that's being thrown around everywhere. You know, some DNA sticks, some DNA doesn't. So Earth is spewing DNA out. And it could be in the form of bugs. It could be in the form of arachnids. They resist a lot. So maybe it's a scorpion because it just resists everywhere. It just gets spewed out and it's just floating through space, you know.
They are good
floating
rafters.
Through space, and then it lands on this nice, juicy planet. Ah, this is lovely. And what's going to happen next?
Well, if it's a female, then it's pregnant. Has babies.
And it has babies. And then this is the beginning of a great movie. She's going to change her career, and now it's going to direct a new movie on...
Scorpions in space.
Scorpions in space. I would totally watch that. Well, thank you both so much for being on the show today.
Thank you.
You know, Ariel, when you said you wanted to do an episode about Starship Troopers, there are so many space-related things in that film. Is it the hyperdrive system? Is it politics in the future? And you chose bugs, and that was super interesting.
Yeah, bugs in space, I think, is a pretty awesome topic. And to have two people who actually specialize in bugs talking about all the things that were realistic and not was really, really fascinating, because there was just tons of stuff that I was like, clearly that's fake. That doesn't happen in real life. And they're like, oh, no, that's a real bug.
Right, because you think that as the filmmakers, when they made the film, that, you know, they were probably inspired by bugs, but they took a lot of liberties. And they took it seriously. Like, you talked about how there were true things. Like, it wasn't just dismissed as a silly movie character or plot point.
Yeah, it actually made me appreciate Starship Troopers that much more, because I felt that they, you know, did as good as they could. And I feel like even though it's a film from 1997, it still absolutely holds up, because everything's sort of done in the same visual consistency and everything sort of just is held together really well. So I think it's a good film, if you haven't watched it recently, to rewatch it. It holds up well.
I think before we started recording, we talked about the kids stomping on the bugs being a tragic moment. That I did not empathize with that when I first watched the movie. And now I think I've come all the way around.
Yeah.
So yes, I would not
don't kill the bugs
on those specific Madagascar cockroaches.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for listening to the episode or watching the episode. Offworld is available as a podcast as well. If you don't know, you can also find it at test.com/offworld with our whole library of episodes. And we'll be back next time with another Space Talk.